Pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate, you're listening to news, views and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Welcome back, dear listener. Episode 53, 30th of July. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove. I'm Trevor, the Iron Fist. With me is Scott. You can hear him chortling in the background. Why are you?
It might have taken a week, but still in all, my original prediction has been proven to be correct.
You have.
And he has been returned with a working majority, not a very big majority, but he's looking like he's going to end up with 77 seats. You lose one as a speaker, that leaves you with 76. So he's in control.
Yep, and you're laughing because you claimed the six-pack, so...
I've claimed the six-pack, yes.
So, okay, well, I've got one sitting in the garage ready for you next time. Oh, next meeting we go to, I'll hand it over in a ceremony.
It'll be Sunday, though, isn't it?
Yeah, but it was a near-run thing. Like, at the time that I made the bet, it seemed outlandish, the thought, but it proved to be not that far off the mark.
Well, I mean, I did find it rather amusing that a couple of days before, it was the last episode 51, where you said to me that you'd be prepared to hand over four beers now.
Yes.
In exchange for if we just call off the six, and I said, "Nah, we'll go to the end."
Yep.
And then while I was over at your place watching the results, I thought to myself, geez, maybe I should have taken you up on those.
Yeah, I think I actually withdrew the offer. So
you did withdraw the offer, yes.
Yes, but yeah. Scott, on the counting front, so bear with us, dear listener. Well, we've still got a little bit of election talk to get through before we start on the truly secular religious stuff. But Scott, have you looked at the latest count?
Of the Senate?
Yes.
So, yeah, 3,800 or something or other.
Yeah,
I saw
3,715. So
yeah.
So Scott, we have made some headway.
We have made some headway because there was 2,600 in the last election, wasn't it?
Hmm.
Yeah, so 1,100 more than what we got last time, yeah. Which is all right.
We're up 39% by my calculations, Scott. At this rate,
pretty good.
We'll be in power in about. In about 85 years.
100 years. But, yeah. Yes.
But that's only with 77% of the vote still counted. So it's possible at the current rate that we might get up to about 4,500. So,
is that right? Okay.
So we'll see how that pans out. Interestingly, Scott, like we are only a handful of votes behind the Palmer United Party.
Oh, is that right?
If we could have said that last election, we'd be in power, and I'd be talking to you from Canberra. Like
you would be, yes.
So that fell over very quickly.
It did. It really did. You know, they got a senator last time.
Yep.
And that would have taken 500,000 because it was a half senate election last time. But you know, they certainly lit up the place very brightly and then just fizzled out very quickly. So I suspect they'll go the way of the dodo before too long.
Scott, when I look at the count and you scroll down to the bottom, and this is the part that I like and I'm sure the listeners appreciate, it has number of formal votes, 2,298,191, and has a quota of 176,784. And you and I both know that you divide by 13 and you'll get the 176. We know exactly how it comes about. So in previous times, you might have looked at that and thought, how did they actually arrive at that figure? But we know exactly. So
yeah. So
that's good. And, you know, talking of groups that have gone the way of the dodo, and maybe it will be the secular party next time, but let's hope not. But because I was comparing the results from last time, you know, some of the parties that are no longer around... The Australian Republicans, Scott?
They're gone, are they?
Australian Protectionist Party, Stable Population Party, Building Australia Party, No Carbon Tax Climate Skeptics. I guess they just went to the Hansons. Stop CSG. Smokers' Rights. Stop the Greens. Quite a number have disappeared, or at least disappeared from the Queensland Senate count. So,
yeah.
So anyway, that's enough of the count at the moment, I think. Oh, one other thing. Just looking at it, I was looking at the ABC News sort of results, and they were giving the overall tallies for the nation. And, you know, Labor Party throughout the nation, as a first vote, got 35%. Liberals, 28%. Greens, 9.8%. Liberal Nationals, 8.5%. Nationals, 4.9%. Guess what the next group was, Scott?
One Nation.
No.
No? Okay.
No.
I don't know. Couldn't tell you.
Well, let me just see. Where isn't One Nation on this? Why haven't they appeared on this list? But Christian parties, 3.6%.
Really?
Mm. So you're right. Why isn't the One Nation party on this list? I have to work out why they aren't here. But Christian parties were the next biggest one. So they've amalgamated all the Christian ones and figured they were the next biggest group. Then it had Nick Xenophon, Catters Australia, blah, blah. I'll have to look at that figure and see why One Nation missed out. But just goes to show Christian parties are a big group there, Scott.
Yeah, they are. Mm. It is. It's a worry that they are as big as they are. Mm. And they are. They don't seem to be going anywhere either, do they?
Mm. Scott, we got a lovely little message from a guy called Sean. Not the Sean that you and I know, but a different Sean, saying, "Just wanted to say thanks for the work you are doing with the Secular Party. I'm thinking of joining and would be great to find out more of the grand plan to bring the religious mob back down to earth. Even though you only got 2,500 odd votes, please keep on going. I voted for you too, and from now on I'll be spreading the word and preaching the gospel of the Secular Party."
Well done. Thank you very much,
Sean. Thanks, Sean. You've warmed the heart of an old secularist with those words. Thank you. Scott, I think we mentioned, actually, last week that the Chilcot Report would be coming out.
Yes, and it is out.
Mm. And?
And it's...
Well, I'm going to take a guess that you haven't read it.
I haven't read the whole 2.5 million words. No, I haven't. But I've read a lot about what's been said about it. And the Brisbane Times, Chilcot Report, the mind-boggling incompetence of Bush, Blair, Howard laid bare. Chilcot's unambiguous findings include there was no imminent threat from Saddam Hussein. Well, I don't think anyone's arguing there was no imminent threat from him. A strategy of containment was preferable to military intervention. Absolutely it was. There was no justified certainty to London's judgments on the severity of any threat imposed by Iraq's WMD. I don't know about that, but clearly they didn't find any WMD afterwards, so the intelligence was clearly flawed. Blair was warned explicitly, but chose to underestimate the consequences of the 2003 invasion. That didn't surprise me when I heard that. And planning for managing post-Saddam Iraq was inadequate. Well, that was clearly evident. You know, the whole thing has disintegrated down into a bitch fight. And it is Islamic State versus everyone else. And it's awful.
It's not often, is it, that something like this is called into question by an independent inquiry so soon after the event? I mean, history will often condemn leaders for things they've done in terms of starting wars. But
generally, the leaders have to be dead first.
Yeah, and so thoroughly. So it's really great to see, because it's an abomination that we entered that in the first place. So this Chilcot has really served it up to Tony Blair in particular, given it's a UK report. And a little bit of passing mention of John Howard along the way. But a couple of interesting things I got from that article, Scott, was that, you know, there's this feeling that we have to agree to everything that the US suggests. if we want to maintain a proper alliance with them. Like, that's part of being a good alliance partner. And this article makes the point that the UK had differed with the US on a number of occasions previously on Suez, Vietnam, the Falklands, Grenada, Bosnia, the Arab-Israel crisis, and Northern Ireland. And none of that had a lasting impact on the partnership. So you can disagree with the Americans on things and still stay friends.
Exactly.
Mm. And the other one was that in relation to the Iraq War, France and Germany, who didn't sign up and join up, it hasn't affected them in terms of their, you know, relationship with the US. It's not like the US isn't prepared, you know, thinks any less of those two as a result. So this whole notion that we've got to do everything that the US wants us to do, otherwise we'll lose our benefits as a good alliance partner. This article makes the point. History is showing with other incidents and other countries, it's just not the case.
Mm, exactly.
Mm. So I like this bit where it says, the justifications, if the reasons for going to a war in Iraq were valid, then we'd be invading a different country every month. So places like Iran, North Korea and Libya were far greater threats than Iraq in terms of the reasons given for invading Iraq at the time. And the article says the truth is that this trio, namely Bush and Blair and Howard, wanted to invade Iraq because they thought it would be easy. They figured it would teach the rest of an uppity world a lesson on the extent of American power. Instead, we were shown the limits of American power. How true that is.
That was very true. I think they were right in assessing that the war would be over quickly, but the WAR, the small WAR, has dragged on.
Mm.
You know, the initial victory was there quickly, that sort of stuff, but following on from that, it has proven to be a disaster.
Well, very on in an episode, I played a tape of a US, a female sort of soldier, questioning either Rumsfeld or
Rumsfeld Cheney, was, yes.
Yeah, and saying, well, what are the plans?
What's the plan for the post-war?
For post-war that we just doesn't fall into a disaster. And he said, oh, is there a man in the room? Because he could not answer the question. So...
Mm.
Anyway, on the same topic, John Menadou, probably our favourite blog, I'd say, Scott.
Yeah.
He's come out and he's looked at it from the point of view of the Murdoch press. And a couple of weeks ago you said you didn't have very strong feelings about the Murdoch press. But give me another 52.
I'm about to be told off, eh?
Give me another 52 episodes, Scott, and I reckon you'll be changing your tune. But John Menadou points out that basically Rupert Murdoch was pushing for that war all along, and he's quoted now some of the things that Rupert Murdoch said. So in 2003, Murdoch said, "We can't back down now. We hand over the whole of the Middle East to Saddam. I think Bush is acting very morally, very correctly. The greatest thing to come of this to the world economy, if you could put it that way, would be US $20 a barrel for oil." Like, he openly admitted an oil motivation. A few weeks later, Murdoch said, "We worry about what people think about us too much in this country," referring to the US. "We have an inferiority complex, it seems. I think what's important is that the world respects us. The US troops would soon be welcomed as liberators." That was in April 2003. And when things fell into chaos, Murdoch said, "There's tremendous progress in Iraq. All the kids are back at school. Most of Iraq is doing extremely well."
You know, what planet is he on?
It's the planet where it's in his economic interests that there was a war. So he sold a lot more papers and got a lot more media time. People, you know, that's the planet that he was on, was planet Rupert Murdoch and his own view of his own best interest. And the thing about Murdoch is he controls his underlings so much, Scott. Like, it's not like he's just mad, but his editors and newspapers and whatever can sort of, you know, conduct their independent line. Like, he's right on them. So, have you heard of this? Have you? So, from The Australian is a guy called Greg Sheridan. So,
yeah,
he's the
foreign Greg Sheridan,
editor.
Yeah.
So, he's often on panels and things. And so, John Menadou, in the same article, has found quotes from Greg Sheridan when he was foreign editor of The Australian. Greg Sheridan said, "George W. Bush was really a modern Winston Churchill." For goodness sake. And then in April 2003, again Sheridan, The Australian, said, "The eagle is soaring. The bald eagle of American power is aloft, high above the humble earth, and everything it sees is splendid. For as it soars and sweeps, it sees victory, power, and opportunity."
For God's sake.
Finally, just with, you know, while we can...
Can he spell sycophancy or not?
Well, so with those comments, like, how wrong can you be? Yet I was thinking to myself, I was reading that, hang on, I'm sure I've seen Greg Sheridan on Q&A, for example. So sure enough, quickly Googled Greg Sheridan Q&A, and there was an episode here, and for his, you know, he's one of the panellists, and on the program, it describes him as this: "Greg Sheridan is the Australian newspaper's foreign editor and is one of Australia's most respected and influential analysts of foreign affairs." Should we ever just bother watching Q&A ever again if they're going to put Greg Sheridan on and allow that as his bio?
That is really sickening to hear that. I mean, Q&A used to be quite a good program.
Yeah.
It has got really pathetic of late, though, and that just makes it incredibly pathetic.
Mm. So, you know, this is the thing. Somebody like Greg Sheridan can make an enormous error of judgment like that, and he can get away with it. Like, he is appearing on panel shows as some sort of expert on things. And having written complete rubbish like that. So, and finally, somebody like Andrew Bolt. What a great article by Menadou for finding all these. Andrew Bolt in 2002 wrote, "Let me spell it out slowly for Labor politicians. Saddam won't let in inspectors." But then 2 weeks later, when the inspectors were admitted, Bolt didn't think it worthwhile apologising. And then, following the 2005 Iraqi election, Bolt said, "At last, democracy has come to Iraq, and yet our sneering elite insist it would have been better to leave the murderous Saddam alone." So,
yeah, go on.
No, that's it. Like, these guys couldn't be more wrong, yet they've got all the airtime in the world to now put forward other views, and they get away with it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone really, even on the side of those of us who are opposed to the war, are mourning Saddam's passing.
No.
I think a lot of us are happy that he's gone, but not happy about the way he was removed. Mm. And I do think that had the war been justified by the United Nations, that would have been a different story.
Yeah, well, they wouldn't have given the facts at the time. Otherwise, they'd be justifying wars against North Korea and all sorts of people right now.
Exactly.
If that was the case.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Paul Keating was in the media. He just said John Howard should hang his head in shame for doing what he did.
Yeah. And it's pretty hard to argue with him.
Mm. So, anyway, that's the Chilcot Report and what people have to say on that. And it will be interesting. It's just a great indictment on John Howard and Tony Blair and George W. Bush, all there in black and white.
Hmm.
Scott, apparently, are you feeling unhappy?
Am I feeling unhappy?
Yes.
No, I'm fairly happy. I've got a six-pack of beer coming to me on Sunday. So, you know.
According to evangelical groups, the gay lifestyle is unhappy.
Oh, right, okay. Oh. Well, no, I'm not feeling unhappy. Right. No.
One other piece of bad news. Homosexuality is one of those things that send people to hell.
Oh, well, at least I'll have lots of friends down there with me.
So this, dear listener, comes from an article. There's an evangelical group, Hunter Bible Church. I think they're part of another group. If I can find their name, I'll find it. But basically, this is a group of evangelicals who don't have their own church premises at this stage. So what they're doing is they're hiring state school buildings and halls and conducting their affairs on weekends. And there's a guy called Darren Morgan from Human Rights Advocacy Australia, and he's been going to their services and also researching recorded sermons online and finding all the usual, you know, the things I've just said about the gay lifestyles. Well, finding these sermons where this evangelical group is doing some good old bashing of homosexuals and other
good
people.
Good old-fashioned gay bashing.
Yeah, good old-fashioned gay bashing. So he's recorded the stuff. He's also got it off the internet. And he's then contacted the education department and said, well, you're leasing out your premises to a group which is not working in a way that's to the public benefit. They're conducting these nasty sermons promoting, you know, hatred against gay people. And he's having some success, Scott.
Hmm.
Some of the things that this group has said is the gay lifestyle is unhappy, homosexuality is one of the things that send people to hell, and they're quoting sections of Leviticus, including references to the death penalty as punishment for the sin of homosexuality. So, yes, members of the Fellowship of Independent Evangelical Churches who don't own their own churches. So, dear listener, if you hear of a group of religious people who don't have their own church and are using public facilities like schools, they can actually get booted out on the basis of this sort of antisocial behaviour in their sermons.
And it is a bloody good thing too, because you've got to put up with the nonsense that they do sprout if they're in their own premises.
Mm.
But if they're using publicly provided premises, then I think they've got to be more careful about what they say. So yeah. I'm all in favour of that.
Mm. So, as you know, I subscribe to the Bible Society, and they had an article about this where they were shocked that that this group was being attacked. And
they were calling out the persecution card, were they?
They were, in fact. Yes. So there was a fellow, John Dixon, from the Centre for Public Christianity. There's a group for everything, isn't there? Now, this guy actually...
There is a group for everything, yeah.
Remember when we had that thing about the Ferris group and they were interviewed on television and the Ferris guy got totally smashed by the religious guy who came over much more smoothly with his delivery of what the rules were? Well, that was this guy, John Dixon, who's quoted in this article. Same guy from Centre for Public Christianity. Scott, I'm going to just digress for a moment. Centre for Public Christianity, I'm going to start a list because, as you know, I've got a bit of a bee in my bonnet with these groups that just... There's a group for everything in the religious world. And I think every time we come across one now, we're just going to start our... We're going to say we start our own group with a slight variation. So I'm saying...
Centre for Public Atheism or
Centre for Public Secularism. How about that?
Yeah, okay. So, that sounds good,
So... So we'll just say that we've created the Centre for Public Secularism. Would you? I'll be a founding director, and would you like to be executive director, senior research fellow, director of media, senior fellow, or a chair? What would you like there?
I'll take the chairman of that.
I'll be the chair. All right.
Yeah. So no worries.
Every time we get a group like that, we're going to just do our own version and see how many we end up with at the end of year two. So this is now also the Iron Fist Velvet Glove and Centre for Public Secularism. Okay. The Iron Fist, the Velvet Glove and the 12th Man are all members of the Secular Party. There may be other contributors to the show who are also members. That does not mean that every opinion given on this show is policy of the Secular Party. To find out what is policy, go to the website of the Secular Party, and while you're there, think about joining and signing up, because we need more secularists in this world. Thanks. But I digress. Back to this article. So John Dixon...
We're on the Bible Society, aren't we?
Yeah, from the Bible Society, John Dixon. He said, complaining about activist guy, they search for references to same-sex relationships, package up the quotations in a manner that suits their cause, and then write formal complaints to the Department of Education about homophobic sermons being preached in school facilities. For example, they will take a preacher's passing reference to the Leviticus death penalty and cast it as the preacher's own view.
You know, if the preacher is going to use Leviticus in such a way, he's got to expect it's going to come back on him, can't he?
Yes.
I mean, there's no other way to paint Leviticus. Leviticus is a hate-filled bloody book.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's...
Well, this is what the pastor said. He said, in chapter 20, God states the death penalty for those who disobey. And notice throughout, if it is not the death penalty, it's being cut off from the people of God, which is still death, not just instant death. And so God is serious about sexual purity. I mean, that's not a passing reference. That's...
No, it's not a passing reference at all. That's a full-blown bloody... What's the word I'm groping for? He is not calling for the death penalty for homosexuals, but he is saying that that is an appropriate punishment for us.
Yeah. He goes on, John Dixon from the Centre for Public Christianity. This isn't fair play, he wrote. And it's coming up to the bit I really like. Hang on. Let me see. Murray Campbell, a conservative Baptist minister in Victoria, points out that the internet has made church activities much more accessible to the public. And I'm quoting him here. Our sermons and websites are available to whoever is interested, including wacky atheists, angry secularists, and agenda-driven journalists, he wrote on his blog.
Well, you know, let's hope that that sort of thing keeps them well-behaved.
Yeah, that's interesting, because, you know... I haven't been shy of calling, you know, the religious groups nutbags, but I've never...
No, you're an angry secularist,
yeah,
don't you?
Yeah, but I've never seen it turned around the other way. So it's interesting to see that a first, I think. Wacky atheists and angry secularists. Scott.
Oh, dear.
Okay. Yes, dear listener, this is the Iron Fist, the Velvet Glove, and home of the Centre for Public Secularism. Scott, while we're on this, we need to catch up on a few from previous episodes. So we'd previously had the Catholic Education Commission of Victoria, and I think we're now home to the Secular Education Commission of Queensland.
Right, okay.
There was also the one which was the Uniting Aboriginal and Islander Christian Congress, and I think we're now... the Unified People's Secular Congress.
Okay.
Yeah. That's Secular Congress, not Sexual Congress.
Right, so that's three we're up to now.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, okay. On that one, you can be the Episcopal vicar on that one, Scott.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
And there's another group we dealt with at one stage, which was called Life, Marriage and Family. And I'm going to call our version of that Death, Divorce and Unrelated.
Yeah.
I'm going to list all those and we'll sound like a massive organisation. Now, Scott.
Absolutely.
I've got one. I love a good theory or an adage or something that can be applied in many circumstances.
Yes.
And I haven't told you this one before. I kept this one aside. But in our discussions, or maybe you looked this up, in our discussions within the secular party, talking about potentially name change of secular party because lots of people don't understand the word secular. A lot of to-ing and fro-ing, yes, back and forth. And one of the writers' members said, you know, there's a risk here that we're guilty of bike shedding. Did you see that comment?
I must have done, but I can't recall it.
Right. And he had a little link to after it as a what he meant by bike shedding. And this is a fantastic theory to get around. So it comes from a guy called Parkinson, who Parkinson's law of triviality, which is that members of an organisation give disproportionate weight to trivial issues. So I think we've all been part of committees that have done that. And
yes,
what he gives to illustrate his point is the example of a fictional finance committee meeting with a three-item agenda. The first item on the agenda is signing of a £10 million contract to build a nuclear reactor. The second item on the agenda is a proposal to build a 350-pound bicycle shed for the clerical staff. And the third item is a proposal to spend £21 a year to supply refreshments for the Joint Welfare Committee. And what he says is that the £10 million number is too big and too technical, and it passes in 2.5 minutes. But the bicycle shed is a subject understood by the board, and the amount is within their life experience. So, for example, committee member Mr. Softley says that an aluminium roof is too expensive and they should use asbestos, and Mr. Holdfast wants galvanised iron, and somebody else questions the need for a shed at all, and blah, blah, blah. And everyone can visualise a bike shed, and discussion goes on for 45 minutes. With a possible saving of £50, and members sit back with a feeling of accomplishment. And the same happens with the third item about the coffee. Every man there knows something about coffee and is going to put their 2 cents worth in. And if you can sometimes in these committees, if you're bike shedding, you're actually taking the easily understood but relatively trivial thing and arguing forever over that, and the really big figure and the complicated one just gets passed over with no discussion.
Yeah.
I reckon, Scott, the Australian community has done that with submarines. Like, the submarines just went...
You're probably right. It's, the submarines number was so gigantic, I dare say that people have just passed it over.
And the whole idea
was so gigantic.
Yeah, and the idea of trying to understand different submarines and purposes and blah, blah, blah. People are going, oh, just that's too hard for me. So just go ahead, do whatever you want to with submarines. Like, I think that was a bike shedding moment sort of socially for Australia, for a lot of Australians. Anyway... So I think
you're probably right there.
So I think bike shedding is a term that I'm going to use a lot over the next little while, Scott. It's going to be a favourite.
No worries.
But there was also, I was just on the same page, and this is a duck theory, which I quite liked as well. And the idea is that if you've got a boss or an overseer, some of them, no matter what you produce, will feel the need to... make some slight change to whatever it is that you've done, just to sort of make themselves feel like they're doing their job. So you could do the most perfect presentation or idea or whatever, and they'll say, yeah, all good, except for one thing, and change that thing. And the duck theory talks about it in this way, of an example of an artist working on the Queen animations for Battle Chess, so an animator for a game.
Mm-hmm.
And the artist was aware of the tendency of the producers to want to change something. So he came up with an innovative solution. He did the animations for the Queen the way that he felt would be best, with one addition. He gave the Queen a pet duck. He animated this duck through all of the Queen's animations and had it flapping around the corners. He also took great care to make sure that it never overlapped the actual animation. Eventually, it came time for the producer to review the animation set for the Queen. The producer sat down, watched all the animations. When they were done, he turned to the artist and said, "That looks great. Just one thing. Get rid of the duck." So, Scott, when you've got a brilliant idea, you just toss in a little thing like that, like a duck. That'll give somebody something to complain about, and then you get the rest of your idea through.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
See, I reckon if I'd have put my submarine submission to the party and I'd have said, you know, blah, 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 but, you know, we're going to have a nuclear submarine, three of them, but they've got to be yellow, and we're going to have, you know, three ordinary smaller Japanese submarines, but we're going to make them yellow. And then by the end of it, everyone might have said, oh, that all sounds pretty good. Just what? They don't have to be yellow.
Make them grey. Yeah.
That would have been it. Had I known, I could have got that through.
Well, you never know.
Yeah.
So, dear listener, in future episodes when we talk about bike shedding and duck theory, you'll know what we're talking about. Mm. Scott, Exclusive Brethren, they were on the periphery of things in the past, but they're in the news a little bit.
Really? Yeah, they're really coming into their own of late, aren't they? Mm. They, I mean, this latest thing about them... the Exclusive Brethren MET school gets record funding. Mm. Where is it? What you need to know on this is that they get $8 per student less than what the... $8 per student more than what the lowest public school gets in New South Wales. Sorry, there it is. At the same time, the school received just $3 less in public funding per student than one of the state's poorest public schools, Liverpool Public. You know, it really makes me sick when I read something like that, because it completely tramples on everything that the whole system is supposed to do. It's supposed to provide funding for schools based on what they need. Mm. And this school doesn't need it, and they're getting $3 less in public funding per student than what the state's poorest school gets. It's absolutely outrageous.
It is. Like, you know, potentially bike shedding is what happens with our education system, because your average person has no idea of how money is allocated in the world of education and how it's done in compared to other countries. And, you know, these guys, they don't have any Aboriginal students, none with a language background other than English, and they're all average socioeconomic. They've got massive amounts of private money coming in, and yet they're getting massive amounts of government money as well. Like, it's completely out of whack that this group is getting it. And that, you know, might be okay if they were some harmless little Amish community, but they're complete
but they're not.
Nutters. They're mean and nasty, and they are, you know, there's been allegations of child sexual abuse. They're one of these groups that you get ostracized if you leave.
Yep.
Like, they're an awful, nasty group. So, they're not just a harmless group of happy clappy Christians. They're
they're evil. They're horrible.
And they're getting
people,
extra money. So, anyway, so that was an article there, and the Labor Party is onto this as well, and they're calling for a bit of an inquiry into this group. So,
I mean, it is necessary. I mean, you know, the Liberal Party, they apparently know which side their bread's buttered on. In June, Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull said he had no criticisms or complaints to make of the controversial Brethren and was happy for the extremist Christian sect to continue donating to the Liberal Party. Mm. You know, that's bloody on the bugle too, isn't it? Mm.
I think it all comes about because no government has been prepared to change the system so that a school can be worse off. So that's why groups like this continue to get massive funding is there's a ratchet in place where they can't be worse off, and groups like this should be.
They should be worse off. You know, all private schools should be worse off. They really should be worse off when it comes to funding that's allocated to them from the Commonwealth. You know, it really is time for parents to pay the full amount that it costs to put their little darlings through these schools.
Maybe
not the full amount, but certainly a much higher amount than what they have been paying.
We need a more equal system, and it's crazy that we've got 40% of our high school students in private schools, and you know, in somewhere like the USA, it's like 10%. Like in most, in most normal countries, 90% plus of kids go to government schools. We are completely out of whack in this country.
Yeah, and you know, Finland is a great example of that. They continually outclass everyone else on the planet, and yet virtually everyone goes to government schools.
So, drinking game participants, ACL, is on the agenda, and actually, you've done well. And submarines were as well. So, Scott, ACL was mentioned in a Crikey article because they've been very active in attacking Labor's plan for education and handing out flyers and basically urging people to not vote for Labor. And the Crikey article made the point that, hang on a minute, the ACL is a charity, and if you want to receive status as a charity, then there's certain rules that have got to be followed. And they referred to the one of the rules is that you cannot be involved, it'll be a disqualifying purpose if you are found to be promoting or opposing a political party or candidate for political office. So that was the gist of the article and what Crikey was suggesting. And I don't know what will come of it, but let's hope something, Scott.
Well, let's hope something comes of it for sure. But the ACL does have a lot of lives, so I suspect they'll still be around.
I suspect.
Long before you and I have gone.
Maybe it'll just make Lyle uncomfortable and have him busy and occupied doing something like this with his lawyers and won't be able to be as active doing his other stuff. If it just distracts him, that will be good enough.
Well, that'll help, yeah, for sure. I mean, it would be nice if he was held up, you know, during the whole same-sex plebiscite marriage thing that comes up.
It's a bit of an old article I've been holding over for a while, but plebiscite, Penny Wan expressed concern that the LGBTQI population would have to endure a level of hatred and homophobia were a plebiscite on marriage equality to go ahead. And Scott Morrison responded.
I know I shouldn't laugh because it was absolutely ridiculous the way Scott Morrison responded. I'm sorry to cut you off. Right. Keep going.
He said, Scott Morrison responded that he also had been a victim of bigotry for his conservative views on gay marriage.
I found it absolutely ridiculous. You know, and it's here it is here. It's not even in the same ballpark. It's not bigotry to have people disagree with you or your position that gay people should not be allowed to marry. Christianity-based religion presided over the white Australia policy, the stolen generation, blah, 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 blah. You know, it's crazy that he carries on like this. And it says somewhere in the article something along the lines of it's not bigotry to have your faith questioned. You know?
Yeah. It's, you know, we talked about it once before about, you know, in an argument, one of the modern debating techniques is to cry victimhood at the first and earliest opportunity. That's a legitimate debating technique now, is to say, paint yourself as the victim before actually making any, you know, substantive points.
And that's the final line in the article. Mm. I'm a victim too, is the confused reply of somebody who doesn't know how to properly defend their position.
Mm.
And the writer has hit, Claire Connolly has hit the nail right on the head. Mm. It was a ridiculous thing for Mr. Morrison to say.
Mm. Just as an aside, Scott, well, we've got Scott Morrison there. You know, like, they're talking now about, you know, legislation. And one of the things that's come up is the superannuation. Like, the one good policy that the Liberals, the Coalition, proposed were these changes to superannuation.
Absolutely. And it really was long overdue, and it is fine work that they put it forward.
Well,
yeah.
But Labor actually criticised it, saying that it was retrospective, which it isn't. But anyway.
It isn't.
And they wanted a different one. So then within the Liberal Party, you've got all these people saying, well, we were pounded at the polls, and the reason we were was because of the superannuation policy.
See, I find that absolutely crazy because they lost all the seats down in Tasmania. They held 3 seats in Tasmania, and now they've got none.
Yep.
I think there's 5 seats in Tasmania in total. One was Labor, one was Independent. The 3 remaining were held by the LNP.
Yep.
They've now got none. And, you know, Erica Betts was one of these idiots who was leading the charge on superannuation.
Mm.
You know, he clearly doesn't know his community all that well, because you don't get an awful lot of superannuation millionaires in Tasmania.
Scott, I suspect the sticky fingers of the Institute of Public Affairs here, because...
Oh, more than likely, yeah.
Because of all the things that's, you know, they've been picked, like, they could have easily said the same about the company tax cuts. Like, nobody's saying, oh, actually, you know, the general public was against our company tax rates. Maybe we should rethink that. No, it's the superannuation ones that are being rethunk, and not the company tax ones. Like, it's just, it doesn't surprise me. It just seems so obvious to me that it doesn't make any sense based on the facts, but it's a purely a self-interest ploy by a lot of people to say, oh, the reason we won the election was because of the superannuation changes. Let's not push that through. And it's going to be the one where they're actually going to get support from Labor, who will probably help them, you know, in that regard. So
I find it ridiculous that they would consider walking away from those superannuation changes. And I suspect they won't. Because, you know, they've got senior ministers that have been arguing for it. Morrison and what's the German bloke? No, the Belgian guy that's from the German speaking. Matthias Kuhlmann,
yeah.
Now, they have both argued for the policy in the past, and I suspect they'll continue to argue for it.
Mm.
And, you know, listening to Paul Bongiorno, he said that it was one of the things that they really should have run hard on, but they didn't. And it's crazy that, you know, you look at in the seats where they actually did have, they did lose a lot of their votes, and they weren't superannuation seats. They were seats that were held by mums and dads and that sort of stuff, who were worried about paying full price going to the doctor, etc.
Yeah,
you know.
But it's the neoliberal agitators within the party who will be running the argument that it was the superannuation, and the fact that Labor is against that policy because they had their own one makes me think it'll be interesting to see what happens with that one, Scott. That superannuation.
Absolutely. One. Yeah, we might have to have a side bet on this one, but I suspect that it will be carried.
Yeah.
You know, there probably will be a bruising encounter in the party room, but I suspect it will be carried.
Mm. Oh, I'm tempted to go another six-pack bet on it, but I I'm concerned I'll turn you into an alcoholic if I I'm going to pick my moment a bit better. I was in haste that last time, but I'm going to pick my moment a bit better. But
Well, you've got a second one coming up. We've got the assuming the marriage equality debate, a marriage equality plebiscite goes ahead, and Morrison doesn't actually vote for it.
That's right. I can count on that. I'm very confident on that one. He will abstain or vote against it. Are you enjoying the show and would you like to help out? There's a few easy things you can do. You can like us on Facebook and you can go onto iTunes and leave a positive review. That would be much appreciated. Also, if you're really keen, you could donate to us via Patreon. For details on how to do all this, visit our website. Thanks for your support. And now, back to the podcast. Scott, interesting argument on homeopathy.
Yes.
So we in the Secular Party have said for a long time it's a load of rubbish and the government should not be supporting homeopathy in any form. And in the UK, what's happening is animal welfare people are complaining about homeopathy being prescribed for animals. And it's a really good argument, Scott, because they're saying this stuff is useless and
exactly
it's actually causing distress and harm to animals. And, you know, maybe animals have more rights than humans in this case, because 1,000 of UK vets have signed a petition calling for a ban on homeopathy being prescribed to animals. But I would have thought before this article, Scott, that homeopathy would be a very, very, very obscure branch of veterinary treatment in the UK.
Well, one would have thought so, yeah.
But apparently...
Prince Charles, I know that he's out there with this sort of thing. He has been speaking at a summit on antibiotic resistance, said he was successfully using homeopathy on animals at his organic farm.
Mm.
You know,
well, one in seven.
I think that when people hear the word organic, they think to themselves, "Well, that's got to be better." Mm. Anyway,
one in seven practices offers some form of complementary therapy for animals. Amazing!
It is incredible, isn't it?
Mm. So anyway, we'll see how that goes in the UK about homeopathy. Oh, look, it wouldn't be a show if we didn't have a quick bash of Pakistan over something.
No.
And
this was terrible, wasn't it?
How is this country ever going to progress?
It's got to be... Oh, I mean, when you read this stuff, you just think to yourself, Jesus, they were better off when the Poms were in charge of the place.
Mm.
You know, it's crazy.
So we've got a fellow... Ajun Naz Sindhu, 65, owner and principal of a private school for 20 years, respected by both Christians and Muslims, many of whom had attended his school, educated more than 20,000 students in the junior high and high school, Christian man, but enormously successful. You could just imagine it, like he's educated 20,000 students. Loved by everybody. What he did was he sacked a teacher. It was a dodgy teacher who had leaked exam papers. And that teacher turned around and threatened him with blackmail and said that that they had a tape of him blaspheming the Islamic prophet Muhammad. Now, of course, there was no such tape, but poor old Ajun Naz Sindhu was so scared he'd paid the 20,000 rupees to keep it quiet. And unfortunately, a few weeks later, this guy, the blackmailer, demanded more money. So Mr. Sindhu thought, oh, this is just going to keep going. I'm going to have to go to the police. So goes to the police and says, I've been falsely accused of blasphemy and I'm being blackmailed. And yep, you've guessed it already, dear listener. Instead of levelling charges against the blackmailers, the police made a blasphemy complaint against Mr. Sindhu and also registered a blasphemy complaint against the blackmailers for keeping the blasphemous speech in their cell phones. Now, you would think that perhaps this could all be cleared up by listening to the tapes, but the problem is that the court refused to listen to the tapes because that itself would have been blasphemy.
Blasphemy.
What?
It's a hell of a mess, isn't it? It's ridiculous that they've got blasphemy laws in the first place, but if they're going to have these frigging laws, they should, you know, listen to the evidence that was put forward, and then after they found out there was no such evidence in existence, they should drop the blasphemy complaint and then prosecute the other two bastards for... Yeah,
but the risk is that by listening to
blackmail.
By listening to the tape, that would be blasphemy if, in fact, it turned out that the prophet's name was used on it.
Has he been sentenced to death? I couldn't recall.
Yes. All three of them sentenced to death. The blackmailers, two of them, and poor Mr. Sindhu, and it's under appeal, and, you know, obviously any scheming, conniving person there can just accuse somebody of... Well, actually, I was going to say you could accuse somebody of blasphemy and do this to them, but in fact the blackmailers themselves are also facing blasphemy, so maybe that'll put a stop to
it. Well, this is the thing that I find ridiculous, is that these guys are now facing the death penalty.
Mm.
You'd think that if that, at that point they'd throw their hands up in the air and say, righto, there was no such thing, you know, it's over, we're sorry.
Mm.
Then they would have just gone and got their blackmail charge, surely.
Mm. Mm. Crazy. Ugh, what a country. Ugh.
I mean, I've got absolutely no interest in going to the place.
I wouldn't even fly over it, Scott. Like the risk that the plane could come down and you'd have to deal with them. Could not even fly over that country. Oh, goodness.
Oh, it's amazing, isn't it? It really is sickening.
Mm. Sweden. Very brief article, but...
very powerful article, though, isn't it?
Mm. So, basically... The Minister for Upper Secondary Schools in Sweden, female, Ada Hadzialik.
Yeah.
She says Sweden needs to discuss whether to ban religious schools amid reports that some schools are segregating boys and girls.
You know what? It's really not a bad suggestion.
Mm.
Yep. It really, you know, I mean, I went to an all-boys school, but...
So did I, and I hated it.
Yeah.
It took me years to overcome the dysfunction of growing up in an all-boys school. I'm only just now getting girls who are friends. Like, just... That's a big scar to get over.
Yeah, no doubt. But, you know, it really is crazy when you think about it.
Mm.
That you would think to yourself, well, we're going to educate our sons so they'll have to go to an all-boys school.
Yeah.
I find that bizarre now that I look back on it and I think to myself, no, I don't think that they should be segregated.
Mm. So anyway, they're looking at that in Sweden. And, a very interesting article from Switzerland. This time, where
yes.
The Swiss are denying citizenship to Muslim girls who balked at swimming with boys.
Yeah.
A lot of good stuff in this article, Scott. So, in the latest move to deny citizenship to those who balk at Swiss culture, authorities rejected the naturalisation application of two Muslim girls who refused to take swimming lessons because boys were present. The girls were 12 and 14... lived in the northern city of Basel, applied for Swiss citizenship but their request was denied because they hadn't complied with the school curriculum. So this shows that those who do not follow Swiss rules and customs won't become citizens, even if they've lived in the country for a long time and are fluent in one of the national languages. In April, members of an immigrant family in the Basel area were denied citizenship because they wore sweatpants around town and did not greet passerby, a sure sign they were not sufficiently assimilated. Scott, they interview the towns and say, are these people worthy of citizenship?
Mm.
Great.
It is. They do go to an awful lot of trouble, don't they?
Yeah. This is not the first time swimming has created controversy. In 2012, a family was fined $1,500 for forbidding their daughters to participate in swimming classes. How good's that? It went to the Supreme Court, which upheld the fine. So Switzerland, unlike the United States and many other countries, integration into society is more important for naturalisation than knowledge of natural history or politics. Candidates for citizenship must prove that they are well assimilated in their communities and respect local customs and traditions. In Switzerland, local town or village councils make initial decisions on naturalisation applications. If they decide a candidate is not an upstanding member of the community, the application will be denied and not forwarded on. This is what happened. This is what happened in 2014 to Irving Dunn, an American who has lived in Switzerland for nearly 40 years. He was denied Swiss citizenship because he could not name any of his Swiss friends or neighbouring villages. So he's obviously living as a recluse or whatever he was doing. And they said, no, you haven't integrated into the community. You're not going to get citizenship from us.
Well, I mean, I don't have a problem with that at all. Mm. I mean, like, the Swiss obviously take their citizenship very seriously. Mm. And so as far as I'm concerned, I don't have an issue with it. I think good on them for standing up to it.
Mm. Well, I think that's great that you would say to people, if you want to be a citizen, who are your friends? Like, name some of your friends. Have you integrated into the community? I think great idea.
Yeah, it's absolutely.
Mm. Final article, Scott, on Brazil and anti-gay violence. So most people would have had the view of Brazil as being a very liberal society. Like, we see pictures of scantily clad people on the beaches and it all seems just a fantastic party culture. And but apparently there's a real... in the last 4.5 years, nearly 1,600 people have died in hate-motivated attacks against gays and transsexuals. And people are saying, well, how can this be in a place like Brazil? And the answer, according to this article, is Brazil is suffering from an influx of evangelical Christianity. And that they currently make up nearly a quarter of Brazil's population, whereas in 1970 it was only 5%. And these evangelicals are stirring up hatred of gay people, Scott.
Mm.
So you're going to have to think about crossing Brazil off the list if we're not careful, Scott. Like, that's one that... that you wouldn't want to cross off in a hurry.
I would never have thought of that being a problem in Brazil. Yeah. You know, because you've got Carnival, all that sort of stuff. You'd think to yourself that'd be fine.
Yes.
But when you read this, it's really quite disturbing. I've got a hell of a lot of blue here because I've highlighted a hell of a lot of it. But
go ahead if you want to add any more from that article.
No, because a lot of it is just, just little things. Like, you know, during a televised presidential debate in 2014, one of the candidates, Levi Fidelix, said that homosexuals were unfit to be parents.
Brazil was one of the leaders in various aspects. They were the first to offer drugs to HIV people.
Exactly.
They were the first to recognise same-sex unions in Latin America for immigration purposes.
Yep.
One of the earliest to allow gay couples to adopt children. And in 2013, effectively legalised same-sex marriage.
I think this... the overall impression I got from the article was that what they say, 25% of the population were evangelicals.
Yes.
I think that what that says is that that a religion can have an influence over all society. And that 25% of the population has converted to evangelical thinking and therefore behaves in such a manner. It's quite disturbing. And it is against what their government has set up, but it doesn't seem to have worked.
Yeah. So we won't strike that one quite off the list, Scott, because Brazil would be very attractive, but it's got a question mark on it pending further investigation. So I might get one of our subgroups, the Secular Education Commission of Queensland, perhaps the Centre for Public Secularism, to look into that matter, and you know, we'll get one of our senior research fellows to investigate that and see.
Absolutely, and they can report back to us.
Or it might be a case for our death, divorce, and unrelated group to. We've got a very good Episcopal vicar there who's on the ball with that sort of stuff. All right, Scott. Well, that's it, folks, for episode 53. Thanks again to Sean for your kind words. If you're out there, dear listener, and you're thinking of sending us some... Well, if you're not thinking about it, I can't tell you how much it warmed my heart to have some positive sort of feedback from somebody who's not a friend or a relative, but just some complete stranger. So particularly if you're in that category, shoot us a message to keep our spirits up would be much appreciated.
Absolutely, it really would be, yeah.
All right, we'll sign off. Good night, and we will talk to you next week.
And good night, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye now.
Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf on their phone. And just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It just, it'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation, so you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners, and that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.